Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress, and we are deeply honored to have a very distinguished guest with us today, Bishop Vitaly Krivitsky, Bishop of Kyiv and Zhytomyr, visiting the United States this month. Welcome, Your Excellency.
Thank you.
And we're also happy to have with us Father Alejandro Guevara. Thank you so much for translating for us this morning, Father.
You're welcome, Betsy.
Your Excellency, we're approaching now the fourth anniversary of the crisis in Ukraine, a constant state of war that has affected millions of Ukrainians. What are your greatest concerns as we approach the fourth year of this terrible war?
I think, like every Ukrainian, one of the things that concerns me the most is the tiredness of our people. Together with Ukraine, also our partners, our friends are tired. We know that to get tired is something natural, but it's also something we have to learn how to overcome. This winter, as you know, it's one of the worst that we've had in this past 4 years. And taking advantage of this cold, the enemy is focusing on destroying our electrical systems. And that's why our pain is so big, because we see how our people are just freezing to death. And we are here, we came here to also be witnesses that our people are going through this very big genocide. It's not just a military war. It's a fight against the civilians. And also one of my concerns is that people, because they're tired, obviously, are helping us less. Maybe they're praying for us less. And just as like we felt at the beginning of the invasion, all the support and prayer of all the people, that were very close to us, the same way we are feeling also this tiredness of the people that maybe they've also stopped praying for us. But as an answer to this feeling is what we've encountered here. So many faithful that are telling us, we will never forget about you. We continue to pray for you and to keep you in our prayers.
So what are you doing back in the Ukraine to fight this feeling of despair? Because you said prior to your trip here, when war becomes long, the greatest danger is not only destruction, but despair. How do you fight this despair?
Для нас під час цієї війни по-особливому промовляє Святе Писання.
During this time of war, we see that it's scriptures that speak to us in a very profound way. Because the scriptures, they speak about a certain people that they also went through a lot of despair, a lot of troubling. Let us just think about our Lord Jesus Christ before he entered into his passion, or already on the cross. He gave us an example of how in every moment of troubling or in every despair, how we can learn to turn to the Father. And so that is what we're doing. Each one in its place, in its position, we are trying to look for this contact with the God the Father, because we know that it's from him that we find also consolation.
Right.
He's the one that gives a meaning to all our lives, and especially during these moments of trouble and despair. Prayer is something very important during this time of war. Also, it changes in a way, but also the individual one and also the one in community. And there's people that they find their strength from uniting in prayer, and they get stronger. It's very important, the cooperation of the communities, of the pastor with the parishioners, and so on. And it is extremely important for us, especially during the bombings that we're experiencing, when we get messages from different people, like also, for example, from the U.S., just asking us, how are you? Maybe they don't know how to help concretely, but the simple fact that they tell us, I'm praying for you, that's already a big support. And they invite also other people to pray for us. And that is actually one of the biggest things that builds us during this time of despair, or even better said, during the times of when we're going through a test, so that we don't arrive to despair, because despair is already like a position that you find yourself already with no way out.
Well, I know that that's your primary job as the shepherd of your diocese, but I wanted to ask you one other political question before we talk about all the humanitarian works that you're doing and the needs that you have. For one of your reasons for coming here was, I'm not coming to the United States to speak about politics or numbers, but to bear witness to faith, endurance, and hope. So that final political question I wanted to ask you is, we heard that there are rumors of peace. Ukrainian President Zelensky met with Pope Leo, and we're just wondering, how do these talks stand now, and are you hopeful?
Розумію, що навіть наш президент.
One thing that we have to understand is that our president, when he goes to the Holy See, one of the things that he for sure is not looking for is military support. We're sure that whatever he's looking for, that we don't know exactly what, but for sure is in the field of humanitarian aid. Of course, from his point of stand, it's things that we hear about, but maybe there's also things that he cannot tell us. But for sure, it's about the good of the people. It's a deal for the good of the people. For example, when we speak about the children that we want to give back to their families, it's a just thing. Or when we speak about the soldiers that are in exile to come back home to get them back, that's also a just thing. And there's also many other civilians that also have been captured, and they also have to go back home. We know that the world sees looks at the Holy See as a moral authority too. The Holy See has a long apostolic memory. The church also has a very well thought and elaborated doctrine. And even now during the war, we've had Protestants coming to us telling us that they've read the doctrine of the church, and that has helped them as resources. And we understand what's the cooperation between peace and justice. So today we find ourselves in a position that we have to go back to the documents of the church to learn about how the peace and justice cooperate. Maybe similar subjects the president goes to the Holy See to ask about, right? We understand that his visit to the Holy See, the president's visit to the Holy See, is just the peak of the iceberg of so much work that's around it.
We're so fortunate, aren't we, in our church to have all of these rich doctrines.
And one of the things that we have to mention is that the Roman Catholic Church in Ukraine is one of the minorities, is 1%, or not even 2%, a little more than 1%, not even 2%. Yeah, 1% of the population. But during the time of war, we've understood the greatness of the universal church that is with us. And we understand and we see that the prayers of this universal church, it really brings fruits. And that's what we're giving testimony of.
Do you work with other Christian churches and Christian church leaders in Kyiv to deal with all of these crises?
Так, і маю сказати, що
Yes, and I have to say that some of the mechanisms that are working now are just an effect of something that was already, tested with before. Many of our listeners probably don't know about the fact that in Ukraine, there's a unique Council of Religions and Organizations of Ukraine. It unites mainly the Christian leaders, the Jewish leaders, and also the Muslim leaders. We say that it's a community of communities, monotheistic, of the Abraham, Abraham as a
Abrahamic,
father. Yeah.
yeah.
So with these communities, before the war and now especially during the war, we have been working together the whole time. We are in communication with the government, to with our society, and the decisions that are taken in the community, in the council, they're always under one census, a consensus, sorry. And with very small exceptions, God helps us to always arrive to a consensus. And together with the Christian churches, we also pray together, and especially for the chaplains. And we pray in different occasions, and also since the beginning of the war, 2022, we've gathered every year to do a national prayer. At the end of this month, together with the other members of the council, we're gonna gather by the walls of our parliament to pray together. Our priests, not only the ones that are involved with the military, but also many others, are volunteers that go to the front lines with groups visiting the soldiers. They go in groups of three or four together with the other Christian denominations, and together they preach and they speak about Christ. The Lord has also given me the opportunity to twice go to the front lines together with the other church leaders and visit the soldiers and preach to them about Christ. And together we go there in the same car, we sleep under the same roof, and together we visit the soldiers and we speak to them in one voice. Together we announce to them the risen Christ, and now, for example, during the Christmas time, about the nativity of Christ. It's a sign for the soldiers that just like our society supports them, also the churches are in their support.
What a beautiful witness.
Бо відомо, в цьому часі це дуже.
Because, of course, you know that in this time, the prayer and the unity is very necessary.
Yes. Let's turn a minute to the humanitarian aid issue. We know Samaritan's Purse has been on the ground as well as the Knights of Columbus. Is your diocese receiving the support it needs?
Допомогу ми отримуємо з різних сторін.
Yes, we receive help from different sides.
Зокрема, отримуємо і від лицарів Колумба, від Мальтійського ордену.
We receive from the Knights of Columbus, from the Order of Malta. We're grateful that they themselves analyze the situation and somehow control the situation, and they already know where is needed the most, and they distribute the goods themselves. At the beginning of the war, they were concentrated mainly on bringing generators because we had the full blackouts. And then the time came later on when we had to also start working with healing the wounds and traumas of war. And so we've seen ourselves that we have to prepare the chaplains and also the volunteers chaplains to go to the front lines, because it's a new thing for us, right? It's not something that they studied. As you know, one of the biggest challenges today is the cold. People are freezing. So they are also helping us in this taking care of the people, seeing who are the ones that are in need of the most essential things, and they go there looking for them, and they provide for them also many of the necessary things. So using this occasion also, I would like to thank all the people that help with their donations, that gather the help, that send it, so that Ukraine can receive this help, and so that it can reach the most needed. And I can give my witness that your help is actually saving people's lives.
That's very, very moving. I wanted to focus a little bit on the children as we finish our conversation with a couple of points. You have a very impressive youth program, which includes trauma recovery, especially with your summer programs. Can you share a little bit about those and how they help your young people to heal?
Так, звичайно. І дякую за це запитання, тому що воно нам лежить на серці.
Yes, of course, we can share. And thank you for asking, because it's something that we carry in our hearts. So every people lives in a different way and has to carry the burden of the traumas that they receive in different ways. And it's something that they carry on a daily basis. So children, it's not like they live it less. The problem is that they simply don't know how to express it or call it. They're not always aware of what they're going through, and it's harder for them to express how they feel. Already before the war, we already started the summer camps for the children, and we helped them to little by little develop the programs too. We're looking for the costs, the necessary funds to do the programs. But last summer, we saw that it was necessary to develop a new program for children, for a bigger number of children, but not only for the psychologists or the specialists that know how to do this and they can develop this program, but we thought about the program for everyone, also for the priests and also for other people that will want to be engaged in this. So it was after I came back to Ukraine last year, coming from the US. It was when I funded this program for the Commission of the Youth, for them to start working and start getting this program going. We worked on the biblical side of the program, on the psychological side of the program. We did the big a big game part of the program too, work in teams. They did a special cartoon for the kids. They did a scenario for the children so that every day they can be involved in different activities and just stay busy. The first program was based on the figure of King David. It's a figure that also went through a lot of wars and a lot of troubles. He had friends, he had enemies, and he experienced betrayal. With God's help, he learned how to work with it. He would always find himself in situations without a way out, and with God, he would find a way out. So that was last year's program. This year, we're trying to even make it better, and we're still working on the one for the next summer camp. And we're also looking for help to get this program going and to be sure that we're gonna have it, so that the children of Kyiv that are going through these continuous blackouts, the lack of energy, the lack of heat, so that this summer they can at least leave the city and go somewhere to the summer camp where it could be calm and they can concentrate and healing. So last year, throughout the whole summer and all the summer camps, we had more than 1,500 children. So the subject of this program for this year is Moses and his journey. Our war is already taking too long, so we need to learn patience and perseverance.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful program, and I hope that our listeners' hearts and pocketbooks are moved by your story. I want to have one final conversation about the children of Ukraine and the heartbreaking stories that there are many missing children there. And I know that this week, our First Lady, Melania Trump, said that she was working on this and that she told EWTN News that she had spoken with Putin or communicated with him about this. Are there any reports of success with this, trying to get these children back in this horrifying story?
Насправді я не є залучений.
In reality, I'm not included in the conversations or deals that the Holy See has in regards to this matter. There's certain people that take care of this subject and are working on it. And there's others that they're just working from wherever they can. And there's the ones that are working, we can say, silently by praying for these children. But I do know that during war, the consolidation of the people and when they gather together, that is actually what pushes the things forward.
Вони приносять і будуть приносити добрі плоди.
So I am convinced that when efforts come together, they bring fruits, and they will bring fruits also here in this case. So, as bishops, as ministers, right? Sometimes we serve as intermediators to give certain names, certain information of soldiers, and so many things that can also help and maybe provide some type of help.
How can Catholics here in the United States help your people?
So, first of all, I would like to thank the Catholics that are already helping Ukraine. They're helping with their prayers. They're helping with their material help. They're helping with their taxes, and they're helping to stand against this propaganda. And their meditations and prayers, they can find the truth and witness to the truth. The last things I would like to say is just that I thank you and continue asking for your prayers. That we really need them, especially the ones in the front lines. We're very grateful, especially for the help that we've received from the Conference of Bishops of the US. Most of the time, it's very fast. It arrives to us very fast. It's very effective, and it's saving a lot of people. During this horrible time of war, what we concentrate in the most is to save people's lives, and now especially by keeping them warm, people that are freezing to death.
Що тисячі будинків, багатоповерхових будинків сьогодні знаходяться без опалення, без електрики.
For example, the thousands and thousands of buildings, the whole buildings where apartments of people live, are left without electricity and without heating.
Вони не будуть шукати якогось іншого житла, вони дають собі якось ради в цих надважких умовах.
Many of these people, they don't have anywhere to go. They just have to confront these terrible conditions.
Ми не маємо таборів для біженців.
Thanks be to God that during these 4 years of full invasion, we don't have any refugee camps. And I wouldn't like to say that it is because of the Ukrainians and their unity, but mainly it's because of God and also because of all the help that we're receiving from the outside. And I have to say that this help is saving people. We're in need of funds because we want to turn our churches. And so, like this oasis that can provide all the essential needs for the people in Kyiv and in the suburbs of Kyiv, we had to renew the generators and fix most of them, many of them that were already broken after working constantly all these years. But after fixing them, we find ourselves that they need, in order for them to produce electricity, they need gasoline for them to work. For example, you can imagine the hospitals, all the tools that they have in order to get the hospital going, they need electricity. And to have electricity, they need the
Of
gasoline.
course. Your Excellency, your courage, your faith, your witness is so moving and beautiful. It is a reminder of the things that we have that the people of Ukraine don't right now. And it's a reminder for us to be full of gratitude.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time today, Bishop, Shepherd of Kyiv in the Ukraine. We're grateful for your service. And keep you and all Ukrainians in our prayers during this turbulent time.
God bless you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by our TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. Monsignor, we have now started officially the first week of Lent. What can we learn this Lent, and how can we prepare our hearts in the next 6 weeks?
So it's very important for us not to live Lent as wimps. Many of us do, and we've been trained by church culture and practice over the course of time to think that that all that the Lord is asking of us during the Lenten season is to give up potato chips or chocolate or maybe wine and beer. The Lord's asking us to repent and believe in the gospel. He's asking us to become truly holy in this Lenten season. And I don't know about you, but just giving up potato chips probably isn't going to make me the next St. John Vianney. And so I think that it is important for us to choice test on Ash Wednesday. As we heard when we went to Mass, he told us when you pray, when you fast, when you give alms. He's anticipating that we're going to be doing that rather full time, not just during the Lenten season, but throughout the year. But especially in Lent, the church wants us to ponder the what and the why of these three great practices. And so I'd begin by having us do a little bit of a deeper dive on what he's saying. First, he says, when you pray, don't do it for show. Don't do it for any other reason than for your father. Go to your inner room, which was kind of like a safe in the average Jewish home with no access to the outside, so that you do what you pray in secret. It doesn't mean we can't pray in church in the midst of others. It doesn't mean that we can't pray even outdoors, but we're supposed to be doing it for God rather than for ourselves. And why does God want us to pray? Because a lot of the times our relationship with God has been disordered through our choices. And when we pray, we say, God, you're most important in my life. I'm going to make the time for you. And so we've got to make time in Lent for prayer. Many of us don't pray enough. If that's the case, we should add practices of prayer, whether that be daily mass, whether that be reading over the gospel readings, whether that be going to the Stations of the Cross, whether that means the rosary, whether that means a holy half hour, a holy hour of mental prayer, whatever it be, we would need to start or add something. For those who are already praying quite a bit, it could mean just praying with a Lenten flavor, that we begin to pray just the sorrowful mysteries, getting more deeply into each of those mysteries. It can mean that we take the Stations of the Cross one a day for 2 weeks to our mental prayer. Whatever it be, we're supposed to pray as if our life depends on it, because our life and many others' lives do depend on it. Second, Jesus says, when you fast. A lot of the times Catholics approach Lent saying that they're just really going to fast on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. They'll give up meat on Fridays of Lent, which we call abstinence, but they won't really fast. And sometimes when they fast, even on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, they know the teaching of the church that they can have one meal, and the two other smaller meals that they have can't equal a second meal. But some will push the real limit, like of 1.99999 meals, because they don't really want to fast. They're a little wimpish when it. And I'm not talking about people with eating disorders or diabetics who are in different categories, but for most of us, can we really fast? And how hard are we going to work so that we can align our hunger to God's hungers? He'll talk about those hungers in Mass today through Isaiah 58, in which he says his real fasting that he wants is for us to care for those who are in need, not to turn our back on our own. Lots of these corporal works of mercy, we could say. And that leads us to the third point, which is about our almsgiving. and hungering for what God hungers, for the care of everybody else, for their salvation, for ours, leads us to almsgiving, because the Lord really wants us to become great in charity. Everything else is secondary to the love that we have for God and others. And sometimes in Lent, we might write a check to one organization once. We might give a little bit more in the basket on Sundays, but it won't really impact us so that our life will be defined by charity. Jesus ultimately wants our life to become commentaries in the words of consecration, that just as he said, "This is my body given for you, this is my blood poured out for you," he wants us to be all in and give even our life, not just what's left over, but what's right to people. And the need out there is so great. That's why Jesus says, when you give alms, he wants us to be doing it ultimately for our Father, because our Father has given us the capacity to give alms. As St. John Vianney, the patron saint of priests, once said, everything we've received is just a divine depository in our hands. God has placed a deposit like we place a deposit in a bank, so that we have the dignity of making those withdrawals and giving them to people who need those divine gifts way more than we do. And so I just encourage everybody during this Lenten season not to be wimps, but to be bold, to really work on prayer, really work on fasting, really work on charity, because that's when we're going to become way more like Christ, who's prayer, fasting, and giving him himself to the last drop of his blood, we enter into every Lent.
Thank you, Monsignor Landry.
You're welcome, Betsy. Happy Lent.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Lydia Dugdale, Professor of Medicine and Director of the Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at Columbia University. Prior to her 2019 move to Columbia, she was Associate Director of the Program for Biomedical Ethics and founding co-director of the Program for Medicine, Spirituality, and Religion at Yale School of Medicine. She's also the author of the fantastic book, The Lost Art of Dying, Reviving Forgotten Wisdom. Welcome, Lydia.
Thanks so much for having me, Betsy.
So there's so much to talk about related to your specialty of medical ethics, designer babies, gene editing, organ harvesting, redefining death or expanding the definition of death. But the big news that we're going to start with, the big news is that the state of New York just legalized physician-assisted suicide. And what's your reaction to this, and how does it change your day-to-day medical practice?
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for starting with that question. Yes, so just several days ago, Governor Hochul of New York signed the amendments which she had pushed for. So initially signed the legislation in December of 25, but asked for amendments to you know, quote, make it safer. And, you know, there are amendments. So now there's a requirement that there's a 5-day waiting period. There's an amendment that requires all people seeking physician-assisted suicide to have an evaluation by a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And that's really important, because we know that the same group of people who tends to seek to hasten their deaths through legally assisted means often is the same group that suffers at high rates from major depressive disorder. So of course we want to be finding cases of depression and treating them, especially if it means people won't be inclined to hasten their deaths. So I'm grateful for the amendments, but we know that amendments or any sorts of restrictions in the name of safety quickly become impediments to access. And we've seen time and time again that subsequent rounds of legislation tend to try to get rid of these so-called safeguards or make them more lax so that people can have more access. What this means for me personally as a physician practicing in New York City, is that we have 6 months to try to figure out how our healthcare system is going to participate in accordance with the law, and how we will also give carve outs to clinicians who don't want to participate because of matters of conscience. Mm-hmm. And also how my hospital in particular cares for a largely marginalized, vulnerable patient population. How do we make legal the hastening of death in a way that does not feel coercive to people who might feel that their life isn't worth living or feel the pressure from society to hasten death and just kind of go on and get out of the way because they are a quote burden to the system? So these things make me very concerned. I am a part of the committee that is trying to figure out what implementation will mean for our whole health system. And so more to come on that. But yeah, creates more work. And then I think also ultimately it's going to change the climate. When you live in a society that normalizes the taking of human life, it changes a society. And I don't think it changes a society for the better at all. So I'm not excited to see what that becomes.
Yeah, the Catholic bishops have been outspoken on this, and I wanted to get your reaction to a quote from them. They said, "How can any society have credibility to tell young people or people with depression that suicide is never the answer, while at the same time telling elderly and sick people that it is a compassionate choice to be celebrated?"
Yeah, so that's a great question, comment to put on the table. The advocates of assisted suicide, physician-assisted suicide, do not use the language physician-assisted suicide specifically because they want to distance the medically sanctioned act, the state-authorized act of hastening death for the terminally ill from conventional suicide. So there's a very deliberate agenda of distancing those two. Having said that, in every jurisdiction where physician-assisted suicide or lethal injection, which might be called euthanasia, that's Canada, some countries in Europe, countries in South America, in every jurisdiction where that is legal, there is a concomitant increase in conventional suicide. So it is true that the normalizing of taking life leads to more taking of life. Even if we can't say legalizing so-called MAID leads to an increase in conventional suicide, there's certainly a strong correlation in every jurisdiction where this is legal. So I appreciate very much the Catholic Church's concern that this feels like a paradox. We don't want people to jump off of bridges, but we do want old people to go on and get it over with. And yet, at the same time, advocates would say these are two things that are completely separate, but one, in fact, they're not in many ways. And so I think we need to keep bringing the conversation back to that. But it is hard to put that conversation on the table when advocates are choosing to redefine the act of taking one's own life as not being suicide.
So I know that one of kind of at the heart of this is that people say they don't either want to suffer anymore themselves or they don't want to see their loved ones suffer. But you testified before the UK Parliament regarding the pain endured by people who might want to end their lives. There is your quote, "There is almost no pain that our current regimen of palliative care medicines cannot treat." Can you talk about that? And if that's been true for a long time, why are we still having this problem?
Well, fear is something that a lot of people experience, regardless of how rational it is, right? So, I've spent enough time in the hospital to know that I really don't want to die there. And I know that suffering is complicated. So when people think about suffering at the very end of their lives, the easiest name to give to that is pain. It turns out that physical pain, when you look at data, especially data from Oregon, let's just say, because Oregon was the first state to legalize. So we have the most data from Oregon, if we're just talking about the American context. Only about a quarter of people are actually concerned about physical pain. The kind of suffering that they are most worried about, some 90% are most worried about not being able to participate in the activities that make life meaningful. That is a different kind of pain, but it's more of an existential suffering. It's suffering of a different caliber. So, yes. Modern medicine is extraordinarily good at treating pain. Some of the worst pain we see is when cancer spreads deep into the bones. That can be exquisitely painful. However, for such individuals, we can even deeply sedate people to give them relief. So, At our hospital, we say no one should have to die in pain. And in fact, we have some families come in and say, don't give my loved one pain meds. We want to keep her alive so she can sort of participate in the activities of the dying process. Well, okay, fair enough. But if your loved one is writhing in pain, we won't permit that unless she herself gives permission to accept that pain. But I think in Western medicine in particular, there's a strong value on treating pain. Is there the risk of overtreating pain such that you hasten death? Yes, although it does take quite a lot of extra pain medicines to hasten death. So if pain medicine is given in proportion to pain relief, then usually you can strike the right balance and you're not hastening death. More to say on that, but yes, physical pain is not usually the problem.
So, C.S. Lewis wrote the book, The Problem of Pain. And I wanted to ask you, is it hard for you to, in a really secular situation, you're talking into Parliament or you're at on a panel for the state of New York, to remove that faith component where, in the second Hebrews, we talk about perfection can happen through suffering. How do you balance that as a medical professional and a medical ethicist and a person of faith?
That's an interesting question and a great transition with C.S. Lewis's book title. I love that. Okay, so yes, scripture is very clear that there is redemption possible through suffering. Suffering can do all kinds of wonderful things, not least change our characters, teach us to persevere, teach us to hope. In fact, most people for whom I have cared, who have a redemptive view of suffering on some level, will say something to the effect that I wish I had never gone through that, but having gone through that, I see what I learned from it. It taught me amazing things. And so on some level, I'm glad for it, though I'm not glad for it, kind of thing. So that it's pretty common, even in a secular context, for people who are willing to kind of work with their suffering to see that they have grown through it. Now, of course, in a religious context or an explicitly Christian context, we have language for all of that. But there's nothing, to my knowledge, in scripture that says, therefore, go try to inflict yourself and bring suffering upon yourself.
Right.
It's very clear that to me that medicine is a gift from God. I mean, you even read the history of medicine and you see that for some of the early discoveries, it was faith commitments that drove people to discover how to care for the sick in a way that was life-giving and godly. The faith commitments drove a lot of early discoveries in healthcare and medicine. So this is a gift from God to be used, and if some of that gift is to mitigate suffering, then I think we should use that good gift. It's a little bit like saying, however you want to make sense of this, God has given us the tools to build houses and stay warm. Therefore, when it's sub-zero weather, we'll grow in our suffering if we just sleep outside. I mean, that's just silly, right? We have the God-given tools to avoid that deep suffering. But I do think to the extent possible, if we can be conscious, now it's not always possible, but if we can be conscious through illness such that we can sort of participate, I think that's a great goal, but I wouldn't want to suggest that someone in severe agony should forego pain medication just to remain conscious and be able to pray or something like that.
I guess I was just asking, is it hard to argue all of this against physician of suicide without bringing any of your faith into it?
But I think actually, so, what is the strongest religious argument? Well, every major world religion has a prohibition on the taking of human life. So you bracket that and say, all right, I'm not religious. What are my strong arguments? I think arguments for the vulnerable, for the elderly, for the poor, for how they will be swept up in this are very compelling. Now, the counter to this is that, advocates say, well, look, there are no examples of abuses in America. As long as we are only prescribing pills and not doing lethal injection like they do in Canada, there won't be abuses. But there's just a case that was written about about in The Atlantic very recently, I think published this month, of a young woman who had a very traumatic upbringing. She's very clever. She's very had a very hard life, and she ended up figuring out how to game the system. She found some advocates who would help her get this. She, I think, faked a doctor's name or whatever, had the prescription sent. And anyway, she was able to figure out how to game the system and get access to lethal drugs and fake a terminal condition that she didn't have, such that she could end her life. And this was just recently a young, very young woman. So, yes. It is highly likely that we will see more and more abuses, especially for vulnerable populations. And I think that's a very strong reason to be opposed. And then the other reason is, which we touched on earlier, is this idea of suicide contagion, that in areas where you normalize the taking of life, you'll just see more and more taking of life, regardless of whether it is physician-assisted suicide or conventional suicide.
So you wrote in the Free Press in December a piece about the expansion of the definition of death. And can you explain a little bit about that and how that feeds into harvesting organs and the problematic connection between those two things?
Yeah, that's a really complicated question.
Sorry.
So, transitioning to organ transplantation, there are two ways that we can legally take organs. In all cases in the United States, patients must be dead before we remove their organs. Now, the usual way that people think of death is the heart stops. That's the way people have conceived of death going back to the beginning of the beginning. And we understand that the heart stops, the person stops breathing, or vice versa, and they're dead, they turn cold, they get harm. Okay, so in such a situation, you can take out organs. Now, the tricky thing is sometimes the heart restarts after it stops. The other tricky thing is we now have machines that can maintain the heart after it stops. The pressure on the whole organ transplantation industry is to have blood flowing through organs, because as long as blood is flowing through organs, those are good organs that have a good chance of transplanting well. But if the heart stops, circulation stops, there's no blood flowing through organs. So you can see then the pressure to have the heart stop, be able to declare somebody dead, and then to take that same body and restart the heart on advanced life support, such that, within 5 minutes, there's blood circulating through all of those organs
I
and they
see.
are therefore viable again. So there have been a variety of methods to kind of tinker with this state of the body between life and death, being able to declare death, kind of monkey with the body, but then try to ensure brain death because you don't want to bring the person back if you're going to take their organs out. So that's where this whole idea of a new definition of death has snuck in. That's probably its own conversation, but that's just to highlight it. And then the other piece to it, I said there are two ways that you can legally be declared dead and have organs removed. The second is brain death, but brain death is completely a fabricated definition of death that was invented in 1968 by a group of people at Harvard. And their motivation for doing so was twofold, but one of which was to be able to access organs. Brain death literally means no, I mean, it doesn't literally, but we understand it to mean no upper level brain activity. You can't breathe on your own. But if a body that is brain dead is being maintained on life support, it will look just the same as any other person on life support, except that there's no upper brain activity. Is that truly death? Well, there's a lot of disagreement about that because it's a fabricated definition of death. We know that patients who have met the definition of brain death and are legally brain dead have also gone on to go through puberty, get their periods, gestate a baby, etc. So can dead bodies do that? Can dead bodies gestate a baby if a woman is pregnant and becomes brain dead? We tend to say no, except that they can and still be legally brain dead. So yes, we can remove organs from such individuals, but as I said, this is all really complicated. And then this is all against a backdrop of organ transplantation being incredibly lucrative. And so there's a lot of external pressure to figure out how to get organs in a way where we're not killing people for their organs. But if we can declare them dead in some way and keep those organs going well, then it's the best of all worlds because we haven't killed anybody for their organs because we've declared them dead, and yet the organs are so good. It's very messy, but happy to talk further anytime about that.
Well, we just are talking about all these life issues and, how we're interested in the dignity of the human person, on this show especially. So let's talk about the good news, which is your book, which is making people realize that we're all going to die. And you say you have time to prepare for death and you had best start today. So let's use the remainder of the show to talk about you saw this, that people were just in denial. Families were in denial. You resuscitated an elderly man, Mr. Turner, three times, and he eventually died, within a matter of hours or a day. Why do doctors not want to talk to people about this? And let's talk about what you do in your practice to get people to understand the natural acceptance that they will die.
Yeah, so there's a lot packed in there as well. One of the things that hospice and palliative medicine as a discipline, as a specialty within medicine, has done is it has professionalized conversations about death and dying, but it's also segregated them. So in a busy hospital system, if you have a patient who wants to have these end-of-life conversations, rather than you, the treating physician of whatever specialty, being the one to do it, you just call the palliative care professionals and you kind of outsource it. And so what is, so I think hospice and palliative medicine has been an enormous gift to patients, to dying patients and their families, but it has meant that death talk in medicine has been relegated to a group of professionals. And so everyone else kind of falls out of practice. And I say falls out of practice, but this is superimposed on the reality that medical students only get 1 hour or so of how to share good news, how to talk to patients about death in their entire training process, unless they go into a specialty where patients are likely to die. So not a lot of training to begin with. You add to that the specialists, and you're kind of off the hook. And then you add to that the secularization of society. A lot of people haven't really thought about what they think about what happens when you die. Why am I here? What is life for? Those sorts of existential questions. And that creates generations of people who are just ill prepared because they have not thought about this themselves. And I've had colleagues say as much to me that, I don't really talk about death with my patients because I myself don't know what I believe. So that kind of explains the professional side. And I got interested in this question of the art of dying, or the art of helping everyone, my patients, prepare for death, because it struck me that we were really inadequate at it, that patients were dying these terribly medicalized deaths they never wanted. It wasn't at all their vision for how the end of life would go. I'd hear this because I'd hear it from their families after they died, or I'd go to the funerals. And so I started investigating other models, earlier models for how society thought about anticipating death and preparing for it. And that's where I came across the Ars Moriendi, which was, that's Latin for the art of dying, which was this genre of literature, really handbooks for the preparation for death that started after the bubonic plague outbreak of the mid-1300s and were really wildly popular in the West for more than 500 years. Initial versions were related to the Western Church, but didn't stay within Christendom. Well, with the Protestant Reformation, there were Protestant versions, Catholic versions, then Jewish versions, then later secular versions. And so really, this idea that everyone, no matter what your background, your belief system, your cultural values were, could think about mortality just as a matter of fact, and then give some attention during life to prepare for it. That was part of living well. And it wasn't particularly morbid. It didn't dominate the conversation. But insofar as you learned other kinds of arts, maybe the art of conversation or the art of music or the art of table manners or wielding axes, whatever it might be, you also learned this art of dying. And so it really became this lifelong process of maintaining an awareness of mortality, which then helps you live into the fullness of life. Because you and I both know any of our friends or loved ones who have received a bad diagnosis, whether it resulted in a premature death or not, that quickly brings into relief that which matters most for us, right? It really changes the way we value life and we value our commitments and we value our relationships. Everything is different with that bad news. And so keeping the end in mind, just an awareness of mortality does help us live into the fullness of life, help us flourish in our relationships and in that which gives us meaning. And so that's what I've really advocated for through my work over the last 15 or so years. And then most recently, The Lost Art of Dying, my book, to encourage my patients to think along those lines.
I'm just hoping that this new law that has been enacted will somehow galvanize people to take your message and let people know that there is actually a little handbook for dealing with these. And what I love about the book, you talk about the five temptations faced by the dying, and on the other hand, the five virtues that mitigate those temptations. So impatience, patience, despair, hope, arrogance, humility. Can you give a story where you kind of saw this flesh out in your practice with maybe a particular patient or a family that you actually gave them these tools and they did it?
Yeah, there was a patient that I was working on my first book, which is an academic book, when she bursts into my office one day as a new patient and basically says, "I'm dying. I know I'm dying. I was given 6 months to live. I need you to help me through it." And this was our first, like literally our first meeting ever. And I sort of took a deep breath and ended up walking really closely with her. I told her after listening to her for a really long time, I told her about my work and how I was thinking about the Ars Moriendi. I was in the very early days. And it was interesting because she didn't have her own children. She was divorced. And she, but she had she was very close to some of her family members, nieces and nephews and things. And she had an amazing community of friends. And she really brought them in, got them on board, and started talking with them about the art of dying. And she tried to set things up in a way where she addressed her major concerns, her major fears, the things that seemed to be taking away from her the calm, the peace, the hope that can come from a well-lived life. And she addressed those things head on in the context of her community. She had a pastor with whom she was very close. Her church community was a part of this as well. And she even set things up so that she could die at home. In the end, she had a really terrible lung disease, and she gave me permission to write her stories. And I've written her story, various versions of it over the years in different ways. But in the end, she couldn't die at home because her lungs were failing so badly. But she was able to spend almost all of her last days at home. In just in the context of everything that she'd been able to set up for herself with the help of community. And walking with her came at a really interesting time for me in thinking about this. And she was someone who really wanted to engage in the work of living well to die well. And even though she was only given 6 months when I first met her, she ended up living 5 years. So we had this really wonderful season of journeying together. And I was privileged to be invited to, well, to notified by the hospital right when she died. So I scooted over to the intensive care unit right away and saw her just after she died, and then also privileged to be included in the funeral memorial services. So I've seen it play out in this very intimate walk with a patient, but have heard many, many other stories of people who have engaged in practicing the art of dying and how it's had an impact, especially relationally. I will often hear from people who have thought about who they want to be with them at the end, assessed the kind of status of those relationships now, and said, "You know what? I know I want my adult kids at the bedside, or I know I want my brother at the bedside, but we're not at a good place right now. So I'm going to invest more in those relationships that matter to me now, because not only will my living be better, but my dying will be better too." And so I've heard a lot of stories like that over the years, which has been a joy as well.
Thank you so much for joining us. I encourage everyone to pick up Dr. Lydia Dugdale's book, The Art of Dying. There's so much in there, especially the importance of community, your ritual, all the things that we talk about on this show. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.